1. Animal the Cannibal. Cannibals prefer those who have no spines. Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem. Holiday, 1963. I was knee-deep in a temporary pond that seemed to be composed of equal parts rainwater and cow shit when the cannibals began nibbling on my leg hair. "If you stand still for long enough, they'll definitely nip you," came a voice from the shore. The "they" were cannibalistic spadefoot toad larvae, commonly known as tadpoles, and the warning had come from Dr. David Fennig, a biology professor at the University of North Carolina who had been studying these toads in Arizona's Chiricahua Mountains for more than 20 years. At Fennig's invitation, I had arrived at the American Museum of Natural History's Southwestern Research Station in mid-July, just after the early summer monsoons had turned cattle wallows into nursery ponds and newly hatched tadpoles into cannibals. But the real reason I had come to the ancestral land of Cochise and the Chiricahua Apaches wasn't because the tadpoles were eating each other. It was because some of them weren't eating each other. In fact, when this particular brood had hatched about a week earlier, they were all omnivores, feeding on plankton and the suspended organic matter referred to in higher-class journals as detritus. Then, two or three days later, something peculiar took place. Some of the tiny amphibians experienced dramatic growth spurts, their bodies ballooning in size overnight. Now, as I waded, scoop net in hand, through Sky Ranch Pond, a slimy-bottomed mudhole with delusions of grandeur, the pumped-up proto-toads were four or five times larger than their poop-nibbling brethren. "These look like two different species," I said, examining a handful of tadpoles that I'd just scooped up. I also noted that the larger individuals were light tan in color, while the little guys had bodies flecked with dark green. "Initially, people thought they were different species," Fennig replied. Using a magnifying glass to get a better look at my squirmy captives, I saw that the differences went beyond body size and color. The larger tadpoles were also sporting powerful tails and serious-looking beaks. "Yikes! Nice choppers," I commented, always the scientist. "They're made of keratin," Fennig said. This was the same tough structural protein found in our nails and hair. Later, while comparing the two tadpole morphs under a dissecting scope, I saw that behind a set of frilly lips, the flat keratinous plates, which worked fine for detritus dining, had been transformed into a jack-o'-lantern row of sharp-edged teeth in the cannibalistic forms. It was also evident that the jaw muscles were significantly enlarged in the cannibals, especially the jaw-closing levator mandibulae, whose bulging appearance reminded me of a kid with six pieces of double bubble jammed into each cheek, a dangerous behavior I only rarely attempt anymore. Studies had shown that myofibers, the cells making up these muscles, were larger and greater in number, or hypertrophied and hyperplasious respectively, producing a more powerful bite. Of course, the extra bite force was necessary because, beyond latching onto the occasional unshaved human leg, these critters were using bulked-up bodies and the weaponry that accompanied it to subdue and consume their omnivorous pond mates. Not quite so obvious was a significant shortening of the gastrointestinal, GI, tract in the cannibals, with the explanation relating to the dietary differences that accompanied the tadpole transformations. In the omnivores, a long GI tract is required for the breakdown of tough-to-digest plant matter, while a shorter GI tract works just fine when the diet is a fleshy one. Over a three-day period, I watched and captured tadpoles in bodies of water that ranged from tire-carved puddles to bovine swimming holes of the double-wide Olympic variety. Accompanied at various times by Fennig, his wife Karen, their two young daughters, and a pair of extremely personable UNC grad students, Antonio Serrato and Nick Levis, I learned a great deal about the three species of Spia that laid their eggs in such dangerously unpredictable conditions. Much of this information centered on the ecology, behavior, and evolution of these creatures. Of course, the cannibalism angle was there as well, although these researchers, including the kids, treated that particular behavior as perfectly normal. Until relatively recently, though, and with very few exceptions, cannibalism in nature would have been regarded as anything but normal. As a result, until the last two decades of the 20th century, few scientists spent time studying a topic thought to have little, if any, biological significance. Basically, the party line was that cannibalism, when it did occur, was either the result of starvation or the stresses related to captive conditions. It was as simple as that. Or so we thought. In the 1970s, Laurel Fox, a University of California Santa Cruz ecologist, took some of the first steps towards a scientific approach to cannibalism. She had been studying the feeding behavior of predatory freshwater insects called backswimmers, belonging to the order Hemiptera, the true bugs. Fox determined that while the voracious hunters relied primarily on aquatic prey, cannibalism was also a consistent part of their diets. I contacted Fox and asked her about the transition that had taken place in the scientific community regarding this behavior. She told me that her observations in the field had sparked her interest and that, soon after, she began compiling a list of scientific papers in which cannibalism had been reported. Although there turned out to be hundreds of references documenting the behavior in various species, no one had linked these instances together or come up with any generalizations regarding the behavior. By the time Fox's review paper came out in 1975, she had concluded that cannibalism was not abnormal behavior at all, but a completely normal response to a variety of environmental factors. Significantly, Fox also determined that cannibalism was a far more widespread occurrence than anyone had previously imagined, and that it took place in every major animal group, including many that were long considered to be herbivores, like butterflies. She emphasized that cannibalism in nature, which some researchers referred to as intraspecific predation, also demonstrated a complexity that seemed to match its frequency. Fox suggested that the occurrence of cannibalism in a particular species wasn't simply a does-occur or doesn't-occur proposition, but was often dependent on variables like population density and changes in local environmental conditions. Fox even followed cannibalism's environmental connection onto the human branch of the evolutionary tree. After pondering reports that humans practicing non-ritual cannibalism lived in nutritionally marginal areas, she proposed that consuming other humans might have provided low-density populations with 5 to 10% of their protein requirements. Conversely, she suggested that cannibalism was rare in settlements where populations were dense enough to allow for the production of an adequate and predictable food supply. In 1980, ecologist and scorpion expert Gary Polis picked up the animal cannibalism banner and began looking at invertebrates that consumed their own kind. Like Fox, he noted that while starvation could lead to increases in the behavior, it was certainly not a requirement. Perhaps Polis's most important contribution to the subject of cannibalism in nature was assembling a list of cannibalism-related generalizations, under which most examples of invertebrate cannibalism could be placed. 1. Immature animals get eaten more often than adults. 2. Many animals, particularly invertebrates, do not recognize individuals of their own kind, especially eggs and immature stages, which are simply regarded as a food source. 3. Females are more often cannibalistic than males. 4. Cannibalism increases with hunger and a concurrent decrease in alternative forms of nutrition, and 5. Cannibalism is often directly related to the degree of overcrowding in a given population. Polis emphasized that these generalizations were sometimes found in combination, such as overcrowding and a lack of alternative forms of nutrition, a common cannibal-related cause and effect, both of which now fall under the broader banner of stressful environmental conditions. In 1992, Zoologists Mark Elgar and Bernard Crespi edited a scholarly book on the ecology and evolution of cannibalism across diverse animal taxa. In it, they refined the scientific definition of cannibalism in nature as the killing and consumption of either all or part of an individual that is of the same species. Initially, the researchers excluded instances where the individuals being consumed were already dead or survived the encounter. The former they considered to be a type of scavenging. Eventually, though, they decided these were variants of cannibalistic behavior observed across the entire animal kingdom. Although there are certainly gray areas, encompassing things like breastfeeding or eating one's own fingernails, my fallback definition of cannibalism for this book is the act of one individual of a species consuming all or part of another individual of the same species. In the animal kingdom, this would include behavior like scavenging, as long as the scavenged body was from the same species as the scavenger, and maternal care in which tissue, that is, skin or uterine lining, was consumed. In humans, cannibalism would extend beyond the concept of nutrition into the realms of ritual behavior, medicine, and mental disorder. As the study of cannibalism gained scientific validity in the 1980s, more and more researchers began looking at the phenomenon, bringing with them expertise in a variety of fields. From ecologists, we learned that cannibalism was often an important part of predation and foraging, while social scientists studied its connection to courtship, mating, and even parental care. Anatomists found strange cannibalism-related structures to examine, like the keratinous beak of the spadefoot toad, and field biologists studied cannibalism under natural conditions, thus countering the previous mantra that the behavior was captivity-dependent. By the 1990s, Paulus's generalizations had been observed among widely divergent animal groups, both with and without backbones, supporting the conclusion that the benefits of consuming your own kind could outweigh the often substantial costs. Once these generalizations became established, and, as a new generation of researchers built upon foundations constructed by pioneers like Fox and Paulus, cannibalism in nature, with all of its intricacies and variation, began to make perfect evolutionary sense. Arizona's lowland scrubs stood in stark contrast to the lush peaks and boulder-strewn valleys of the state's Chiricahua Mountains. These sky islands, isolated mountains surrounded by radically different lowland environments, provided a spectacular backdrop for my afternoon wade through yet another transient pond. The air temperature had risen to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, which kept most of the area's terrestrial denizens hiding in shade or below ground. But the inhabitants of Horseshoe Pond reminded me of sugared-up kindergartners tearing around a playground, albeit with fewer legs and more cannibalism. By this time, I had already begun to see distinct patterns of behavior in the spadefoot tadpoles that motored hyperactively just below the water's surface. I noticed that the smaller omnivorous morphs generally stuck to the shallows bordering the shoreline. They buzzed through the brown water in a non-stop, seemingly random quest for food, changing direction abruptly and often. One explanation for the patternless swimming behavior became apparent as I waded farther away from the shore, for here in the deeper water was the realm of the cannibals. I stood quietly and watched as hundreds of conspicuously larger tadpoles crisscrossed the pond, making frequent excursions from the deeper water toward the shore in a relentless search for prey. Immature animals get eaten more than adults, I thought. Certainly, although in this case the youngsters were eating each other. They remind me of killer whales hunting for seals, said Ryan Martin, a former student of Fennig's, now a professor at Case Western Reserve, who was also studying spadefoot toads here in Arizona. Martin's comparison was spot on, and I threw him a nod, watching as a tiny hunter swam away from the shore with an even tinier pond mate clamped tightly between its serrated jaws. So why did the local spadefoot larvae exhibit cannibalistic behavior? There certainly seemed to be enough organic matter suspended in these algae-tinted ponds to feed the entire brood and more. As I spoke to Fennig and his team of researchers, I learned that the answer was directly linked to the aquatic environments in which the adult amphibians deposited their egg masses. Formed by spring and early summer monsoons, the transient ponds frequented by the spade feet, are often little more than puddles, and as such they can evaporate quite suddenly in the hot, dry environment of southeastern Arizona. Natural selection, therefore, would favor any adaptations enabling the water-dependent tadpoles to get out of the pool as quickly as possible, that is, to grow legs. In this instance, the phenomenon that evolved can be filed under the rather broad ecological heading of phenotypic plasticity. When changing environmental conditions allow multiple phenotypes, observable characteristics or traits, to arise from a single genotype, the genetic makeup of an organism. To clarify this concept, here are a couple of non-cannibalism-related examples. Water fleas, Daphnia, are tiny aquatic crustaceans, named for a swimming style in which they appear to jump like fleas. In response to the appearance of back swimmers, Laurel Fox's favorite predatory insects, Daphnia developed tail spikes and protective crests. Although the genetic potential for body armor is always there in the Daphnia's genotype, it doesn't exhibit itself until a specific environmental change occurs, in this case, the arrival of Daphnia-munching back swimmers. Here's another example unrelated to cannibalism. The reef-inhabiting bluehead wrasse, Thalassema bifasciatum, is famous for its habit of removing parasites from much larger fish, even entering into their mouths. In this case, however, it's the removal of a male wrasse from its harem of 30 to 50 females that alters their local environment. Rather than waiting for a new male to arrive, something extraordinary takes place in the harem. Within minutes, one of the females begins exhibiting male-typical behaviors. Relatively quickly, the former female transforms into a male, a form of phenotypic plasticity known in the trade as protogeny. The opposite occurs in protandry, in which individuals begin life as males and transform into females. Examples include the clownfish, Amphiprion, whose behavior could have offered an intriguing alternative resolution to the animated film Finding Nemo. In spadefoot toads, though, it's not the appearance of a predator or the loss of a harem's personal sperm bank that initiates the alternate phenotype, that is, cannibalistic larvae. The selection pressure lies in the temporary nature of the brood ponds, where the eggs are deposited and hatch, and where the tadpoles develop into toadlets. The period from egg to juvenile toad normally takes around 30 days, unless, that is, the pond dries out first, killing the entire brood. In response to this particular environmental selection pressure, what evolved was a means by which some of the tadpoles can mature in about 2/3 of the time, 20 days. The increased growth rate occurs because the cannibal larvae are getting a diet high in animal protein as well as a side order of veggies, the latter in the form of nutrient-rich plant matter their omnivorous prey had consumed during what turned out to be their last meal. In an interesting note, Spaea cuchia does not transform into cannibalistic morphs, but has evolved an alternative solution to the transient pond problem. Couch's spadefoot can go from egg to toad in only 8 days, an amphibian record. Though the story of spadefoot toad cannibalism has been well researched, it is not fully resolved. The reason is that no one has been able to identify the precise stimulus within these brood ponds that triggers the appearance of the cannibal morphs. Until recently, the prime candidates were a pair of microscopic fairy shrimp species, order Anastraca. David Fennig and his colleagues proposed that the consumption of the shrimp by some of the spadefoot tadpoles served to trigger the cascade of genetically controlled developmental changes that transformed the shrimp munchers into outsized cannibals. But what was it about eating fairy shrimp that set this transformation into motion? Fennig hypothesized that iodine-containing compounds found in the shrimp might cause the activation of specific genes in the tadpoles, genes that weren't turned on in the individuals that didn't consume shrimp. The prime candidate for a trigger substance turns out to be thyroxin, a thyroid hormone whose functions include stimulating metabolism and promoting tissue growth. A new set of experiments, though, have shown that even tadpoles that weren't fed fairy shrimp could still undergo the transformation to cannibals, indicating that, at the very least, something besides thyroxin intake must initiate the changes. What if it's not what they're eating, but the mechanism of chewing itself that serves as a trigger? I made the suggestion while brainstorming the problem with biologist Ryan Martin. What if chewing on something alive like a fairy shrimp, something larger or something that struggles when you clamp onto it, sets this developmental cascade into motion? Martin shot me a not bad for a bat biologist look. Sounds like a good grad student project. Hey, it's all yours, I said with a laugh. We then set to work, drawing up an outline for a potential experiment to test the hypothesis. Although the jury is still out on the stimulus for the spadefoot transformations, Fennig and his co-workers previously worked on a completely different cannibalism-triggering stimulus in another amphibian. And this one happened to be one of North America's most spectacular species. Tiger salamanders, Ambystoma tigrinum, are the largest salamanders in the United States, reaching lengths of up to 13 inches. These thick-bodied, sturdy-limbed uridelans are widespread across much of the country. Their markings, yellow blotches against a black body, make them easy to identify, but they are rarely seen in the open except during annual marches to a nuptial pond. Tiger salamander eggs are laid in the late winter or early spring, and, like other salamanders, and their cousins, the frogs and toads, their larvae are fully aquatic with external gills and fish-like tails. They typically feed on zooplankton and other microinvertebrates, but under certain environmental conditions, a small percentage of them develop traits that include huge heads, wide mouths, and elongated teeth. Consequently, these toothy individuals exploit larger prey, among them other tiger salamander larvae. Fennig and his colleagues set up lab experiments on fertilized A. tigrinum eggs to investigate the stimuli that set these changes into motion. First, the researchers determined that the cannibal morphs only developed when larvae were placed into crowded conditions. Next, they used a variety of experiments to determine whether the larval transformations might be triggered by visual cues, that didn't work, smell, nope, or touch. It looks like they had to have the tactile cues, Fennig told me. There's something about bumping into each other that triggers the production of the cannibals. Movement and touch-related, I thought, remembering my suggestion about a possible trigger for the spadefoot cannibals. But instead of speculating about my own half-baked ideas, the conversation turned toward the pros and cons of cannibalism, especially as it pertained to consuming kin. One of Gary Polis's general characteristics regarding cannibalism is that immature animals get eaten far more often than adults. Ultimately, this makes larvicide, or infanticide, the most common form of cannibalism in the animal kingdom. Intuitively, it doesn't seem logical to eat the next generation, but the behavior can make evolutionary sense for several reasons. Young animals not only provide a valuable source of nutrition, but in most species they're relatively defenseless. As such, they present instant nutritional benefits, but little or no threat to larger members of the same species, most of which are invulnerable to attacks from immature forms. But beyond acquiring a meal, and as we saw with spadefoot toads, cannibalism enables individuals of some species to accelerate their developmental process, thus allowing them to quickly outgrow a stage in which they might be preyed upon or perish due to unpredictable environmental conditions. In species like the flower beetle, Tribolium castaneum, the behavior may also impart a reproductive advantage, since studies have shown that cannibalistic individuals produce more eggs than non-cannibals. Finally, Many animals maintain specific territories within which they are intolerant to the presence of conspecifics, that is, members of the same species. According to Paulus, crowding increases the frequency with which individuals violate the space of others. By reducing overcrowded conditions, cannibalism can serve to decrease the frequency of territory violations. There are also serious drawbacks to being a cannibal. In all likelihood, the most significant of these is a heightened chance of acquiring harmful parasites or diseases from a conspecific. Both parasites and pathogens are often species-specific, and many of them have evolved mechanisms to defeat their hosts' immune defenses. As a result, predators that consume their own kind run a greater risk of picking up a disease or a parasite than do predators that feed solely on other species. In the most famous example of cannibalism-related disease transmission, the Four people of New Guinea were nearly driven to extinction as a result of their ritualized consumption of brains and other tissues cut from the bodies of their deceased kin, kin who had themselves been infected by kuru, an incurable and highly transmissible neurological disease. More on that topic later. But given its importance, the potential for disease transmission stands as a prime example that non-humans and humans alike share some of the negative consequences of cannibalism. Cannibals, whether microbes or Methodists, who eat their own relatives, can also experience decreases in a measure of evolutionary success known as inclusive fitness, in which the survival of an individual's genes, whether they're from an offspring or a collateral relative like a brother or cousin, is the true measure of evolutionary success. A cannibal that consumes its own offspring, siblings, or even more distant relatives removes these genes from the population, so it reduces its own inclusive fitness. Since this is bad juju, natural selection should favor cannibals that can discriminate between kin and non-kin, primarily because eating non-relatives results in no loss of inclusive fitness. In many instances, this is exactly what happens. Because of the significance of inclusive fitness, it made perfect sense that David Fennig and his colleagues had also worked on questions related to kin recognition, basically seeking to determine if some of their favorite cannibal species would avoid eating their own relatives. The researchers found that their study subjects did so by recognizing cues associated with their kin that were absent in non-kin. Most examples would fall under the heading of the armpit effect, Fennig told me. Here, an individual forms a template for what its kin smell like based on what its own smell is. He used the example of a species of paper wasps, subfamily Polistini, that regularly raid the nests of conspecifics to provide food for their own broods. In these species, individuals learn that if an individual smells like your nest or burrow, you don't eat them. Similarly, tiger salamander larvae are more likely to eat the larvae of unrelated individuals than they are to consume relatives. Fennig explained that he and his colleagues determined this experimentally by preventing them from being able to smell. How did you do that? I wondered, envisioning a team of microsurgeons hovering over a tiny amphibious patient. Irrigation, please, nurse. Can't you see this patient is dehydrating? By applying superglue under their nares, he replied. Oh, right, I said with an uncomfortable laugh, before Fennig finished up by assuring me that the condition was temporary. If you're wondering whether or not spadefoot toads avoid eating their kin, Fennig told me that omnivores school preferentially with their siblings, whereas cannibals generally associate only with non-siblings. In close encounters of the bitey kind, cannibal tadpoles release siblings unharmed and consume non-relatives. In the lab, though, apparently all bets are off if the cannibals are deprived of food and then placed in a tank with other tadpoles. In these cases, starvation becomes the great equalizer, and both kin and non-kin are eaten. As I would learn from researchers unearthing new evidence about the Donner Party, this particular aspect of cannibalism spans the entire animal kingdom. On the plane ride back to New York, I thought a great deal about the cannibalism I'd seen in the temporary ponds below the majestic Chiricahua Mountains, and about the tiger salamanders I'd collected at Long Island golf courses as a kid. Cannibal morphs. I wondered whether H.G. Wells knew about their existence when he wrote The Time Machine in 1895. In Wells's classic novel, the time traveler encounters two human species, the child-sized and docile Eloy and the brutish Morlocks, who raise the Eloy in order to feed upon them. Wells explained the Morlocks' cannibalistic behavior by suggesting that they were once members of a worker class, toiling underground for lazy upper-class surface dwellers. The time traveler speculates that a food shortage, that is, an environmental change, forced the subterraneans to alter their diets, at first rats, but ultimately something a bit larger. Eventually, this behavior resulted in a race of hulking cannibals feeding on the surface dwellers, whose own evolutionary path would produce the sheep-like Eloy, pampered, well-fed, and eventually slaughtered for food. Although the Eloy-Morlock relationship was clearly meant to serve as a cautionary tale of the horrors of class distinction, H.G. Wells imagined a biological phenomenon remarkably similar to what researchers like David Fennig and his colleagues are working on today. Many scientists now believe that phenotypic plasticity offers the perfect building blocks for the type of evolutionary change described by Wells over a century ago. These building blocks could be novel traits like the tiger salamander's kin-chomping jaws or the spadefoot tadpole's serrated beak, each having originated as an environment-dependent alternative to an already established ancestral trait, in this case, normal jaws. What these scientists hypothesize goes far beyond the realm of cannibalism and into the very mechanisms of evolution itself. Their claim is that the appearance of new traits in a population, generally regarded as a first step toward the evolution of new species, can occur by means other than the accumulation of micromutations, that is, small-scale or highly localized mutations. The classic mechanism by which new traits, and eventually new species, are thought to appear. Some researchers now believe that given generations, novel traits originating as examples of phenotypic plasticity have the potential to produce separate species. This idea originated with the German-American geneticist Richard Goldschmidt, 1878 to 1958, infamous for his stance that micromutations accumulating over long periods of time were inadequate to explain the evolution of different species. He proposed two additional mechanisms. The first, speciation by macromutations, that is, those causing a profound effect on the organism, which eventually led to the derision associated with his name and the legacy-destroying label of non-Darwinian. Less well-known is Goldschmidt's suggestion, quite correct it appears, that mutations can result in major changes during early development and that these can lead to large effects in the adult phenotype. This hypothesis and the related concept of developmental plasticity, that is, adaptability, are two of the key principles of the modern field of evolutionary developmental biology, also known as Evo-Devo. Goldschmidt's contribution, though, is generally ignored. Along with the even earlier evolutionary biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, the giraffe-neck guy whose story is discussed in an upcoming chapter, these scientists are rarely celebrated for what they got right and are instead derided for what they got wrong. Okay, so now that I'd captured and examined cannibalistic tadpole morphs and heard all about their outsized salamander cousins, it was time to look into other examples of cannibalism in nature and to determine why these creatures were eating each other. I decided that the best way to cover and divvy up the material was to look at what I considered to be the most dramatic examples of Gary Polis's cannibalism-related generalizations. Admittedly, some of what I uncovered was hard to categorize, thus leading me to the realization that cannibalism can extend far beyond the realm of generalization. I also learned that normal behavior or not, Sometimes cannibalism in the animal kingdom can get downright weird.